Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This podcast is sponsored by the Gift of Life Donor Program. Organ donors save lives. Register today at donorsone.org. This is KYW Community Affairs reporter Terry Gregg, and I'm delighted to be in the KYW studios with Dr. Aline Grigosian. She is an organ recipient and part of the Gift of Life family. Welcome to the KYW studios.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. And so, you know, you have a very, your story made me say, wow.
Makes a lot of people say, wow.
Yeah. And so tell it, I don't even want to lay it out. I want you to explain what happened that sort of brought you to the Gift of Life.
So last year, around October of last year, I want to say, I was 30 years old. I was doing a residency, or I still am, but I was in the middle of my residency program in Philadelphia. I was an ER resident at the time, training in emergency medicine here. And I had a cough, and I attributed it to just a cold. So I didn't think anything was wrong. You know, I'm 30 years old, otherwise healthy. You know, I eat well. I exercise all the time. I didn't think anything was wrong. But the cough kept getting worse. And as a physician, you know, we make the worst patients. I didn't go to the doctor for it, which was the worst thing I could possibly do. But at the same time, you know, we're used to getting sick and, you know, we can continue
to
work.
You're in the ER, for goodness sake.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think a couple of my co-residents were sick with the flu. And, you know, so I didn't think much of it. And the other symptom that I had looking back was that I was really, really tired. And again, I kept saying, like, well, I'm a resident. I work all the time. I'm just tired. It's fine. Suddenly, though, in the middle of December, all these symptoms got way worse. So not only was I tired with a cough that was progressively getting worse, I actually started getting very short of breath. And I was, ironically, the ICU resident. So I was the resident on call for 24 hours, just a couple days before everything happened. And that night, you know, I was, you know, going around the hospital, running code blues and doing all of that. And I noticed that I had to stop in the middle of everything just to take breaths. Like, for example, instead of going, I usually use like the stairs when I'm in the hospital, just get some exercise. And I actually found myself using the elevators that night. I did the same thing with the subway that day. Like, I just found myself like getting very, very short of breath with everything, including talking. And my attending noticed too. So within just a few days, everything got worse. On that particular Friday, right before Christmas, I decided to finally go to my emergency room, not as a resident, but as a patient. And as soon as I walked in, I looked really sick. And we have this thing in emergency medicine where we always say that young, healthy people, because generally, if you're elderly, you compensate not as well as young, healthy people. So if you're elderly, once you get sick, you look really sick from the beginning. Whereas if you're young and healthy, you have very good reserve. So you compensate at the, you know, you compensate really, really well. And then at the end, you just crash. So I think what had happened was in those 12 hours, everything got worse. So I went to the emergency room. Apparently, I looked really, really sick. I didn't think I looked that bad. I actually told everybody, I was like, I'm not wearing makeup. Like, that's probably why I look so pale and I look blue. And I actually didn't even want to stay. I barely let them get blood work on me. I let them get a chest x-ray. So mind you, these were all my own colleagues taking care of me. And we got a chest x-ray. They said it looked kind of like maybe a pneumonia, but, you know, we were still unsure because we weren't thinking it was the heart at the time, just because I was young and healthy otherwise. And again, I didn't let them get any blood work, so we didn't. You know,
you're interfering.
Yeah, I was
you're
like, no. And I was like, you know, you can document that I'm not letting you get anything on me. And I was just the worst patient. Eventually, I went upstairs. And once I was upstairs, this all happened within just maybe an hour or two of me going to the hospital. but I ended up crashing. So just within, I don't remember much. Apparently, I remember I got really, really sick. So I got dizzy. I felt really nauseous. I got cold. And I remember looking at my heart rate, and it was maybe at that time, I think it was in the 30s, and then it went into the 20s, and they called something called a rapid response. So that means that a whole team of people come into the room.
Yeah.
My boyfriend is orthopedic surgeon. He was in the room, too. So he got up, and he was like, something's wrong, you know. So he called the nurse in. The nurse came in with a whole bunch of other people. And keep in mind, it's at the hospital that I work at. So the people who rushed in were all my friends and my colleagues and the people that I work with. So they all came in. Apparently, I was pulseless for a couple of seconds. I don't remember anything. I remember feeling, and the one thing that people always say about these like weird near-death experiences, I remember having like a feeling of like peace. I remember coming to terms with like, okay, I might die right now, but I don't remember anything. I don't know how I was acting. Now, apparently, I was freaking out at some point, and I remember, or I don't remember this, but I asked one of my friends, right? I told one of the people taking care of me, like, please don't let me die tonight or something like that. This was all told to me like recently when I asked the people who took care of me what had happened that night. But then, you know, I went into a coma. They medically induced me into a coma after they intubated me. I went to the ICU, and then basically a couple of days later, I woke up out of the coma, and I was told that it was my heart that wasn't working. My heart was barely pumping with the ejection fraction of 5%, which means that a normal person's ejection fraction is usually 65 to 70%, which means that's how good it's pumping. And mine was at 5%, which means like it's barely pumping
at all.
And
yeah,
that was with medication. So basically it was at 0%. And I was told I need a heart transplant. So I went from like being completely healthy, like top of the world, to hey, you need a heart transplant. So I got transferred to the University of Pennsylvania eventually. I was enlisted, put on the urgent heart transplant list at the time. And within days, I got a heart transplant. And that's where I'm at right now. And so I got the heart transplant. I was discharged after a couple of weeks. I had to go on medical leave for a few months. And within that time, I started a blog called A Change of Heart, just because I wanted to, A, like show other people the importance of organ donation. I wanted to express myself. I wanted to show people what I was going through. I didn't realize it would get big. I just was kind of doing it more for myself and, you know, close friends. And then I realized that people were using it. Other people with heart transplants were using it to kind of connect. And then I ended up using it to do like a fundraiser for Donate Life America, which was kind of cool. My goal was to raise $2,000 within 2 months. Like, I wanted to raise $2,000 within 2 months for my 2 month anniversary of my heart transplant through the website. And I actually raised like almost $6,000 within just 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool. And so I used the site for a lot of things, and it kept me kind of occupied for while I was on medical leave. And that was that. And then within 5 months, I went back to work. So it was really, really, really cool. And that was my story, and here I am today.
Wow. And so a year ago,
yeah,
so last year this time, you would have had no clue of where you would be right now.
No, last year at this time, I was actually in New Orleans with my best friend, just having fun. Yeah, I remember that, actually. Just around this time, I was on vacation. Went to New Orleans, and then went to New York afterwards, too. So that's what I was doing with my life.
It's wild how a year changes
yeah,
so many things.
Exactly.
So, I mean, have you thought about the idea? Obviously, you write about this and you've sort of put the numbers together and sort of like, you know, kind of break down some of the issues around, organ donation, because the idea of this freaks people out.
Right, right.
And you're a doctor.
Right, right.
So you kind of know what's involved in this.
Oh, totally. I do. I think as a physician, so especially as an ER doctor, I found it really important for me to become an advocate for organ donation. One of the things that I noticed, mm-hmm. one of the stigmas against organ donation was the fact that a lot of people say, I have heard that you don't take care of me. If I'm dying and you know that I'm an organ donor, you wouldn't take care of me. And then when I tell them, I'm like, actually, first of all, that's not true at all. Like, And even if I were to want to do that, like, I don't even know the status of whether or not you're an organ donor anyway to begin with. Like, that's absolutely not in anything we've ever learned. And I've heard quite a few people say, like, because you said that, I became an organ donor. Like, I just needed someone to tell me that. And even, like, I have chills right now just, like, be saying that. But a couple of my friends from home, friends that I didn't know were not organ donors, changed their mind just by me hearing that.
Yeah.
Or just by me saying that. I'm sorry. But yeah, it's been amazing. So that was one of the things when after being on both sides. And as an ER doctor, you know, we're the ones, at least in Pennsylvania, we're the ones as residents who have to call Gift of Life once a patient. If we, if a patient expires in the emergency room or in the ICU, we're the ones who are in charge of calling Gift of Life, and they're the ones who coordinate whether or not the patient is an organ donor and whether or not they're able to, you know, use their organs and all of that. But you know, sometimes it's part of our job to do that, and it sucks because we don't realize how important that is. Because all I'm thinking about in that moment is, oh, you know, I wasn't able to save a life, but I don't realize that with that phone call, I can actually make a difference. Because with that phone call, there's a potential that that person that I wasn't able to resuscitate can actually go on to save the lives of many other people. So it actually became a very important phone call to me just by this whole experience.
Yeah. Do you think about your donor?
All the time. All the time. Absolutely. I got a letter from them in, I think it was like end of May or beginning of May. I forgot. But I got a letter from the donor family, and you know, it was pretty vague, and I can't say much about it on air, but it was really nice to get to know who my donor was, and I'm very thankful for my donor.
Yeah. And were you an organ donor before this?
I was, yeah.
So you had always kind of committed to that.
Pretty much.
Was it as conscious, or are you much more conscious, or were you always kind of like, yeah, organ donation is good?
I mean, I always kind of knew it was good, but like, I never really like thought about it that much, but now I'm like, oh my God, it is so important. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like before it was kind of just one of those things, but now it has this whole other meaning to me. Being on the list, like nobody understands how important it is unless you're on that list, right? I think New York has this campaign. I don't know which campaign it is, but they say something like, you know, waiting for the weekend, try waiting for a life-saving organ or something. And that like really resonated with me when I read that, because I remember I saw that when I was like in the hospital, and I kept going into arrhythmias like when I was hospitalized at Penn, and that's when I was getting really, really sick. And I'm like, wow, if people only knew, like, you know, they're waiting to have fun this weekend, and I'm just like hoping that I don't die the next day. So it's very important. It's very, very important.
Yeah. And so now you're back at work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you look great.
Thank you.
Are you full resident? Like still doing the crazy hours? Could you do that immediately?
I can't do that immediately. I'm still doing more part-time stuff. I'm more on the teaching side at this point. I can't have direct patient contact, especially with the really sick patients, because I'm still immunosuppressed. But hopefully by next month, I'll be able to see everybody just like I used to. I think my team would rather me kind of go slow with the hours. And luckily, as a third-year resident, hours are not as crazy. So, you know, you're not doing those 12-hour shifts anymore. I'm more down to like 8-hour shifts. So that's fine. Interestingly, right before this all happened to me, like maybe a month before I crashed and I needed a heart transplant, I had just matched into a critical care fellowship program in New York City. And that was the craziest and most ironic part of all, especially for someone in medicine, because, you know, I was about to become an ICU fellow, and an ICU fellow is someone who takes care of patients just like me, like in the ICU. And so my goal is to like become an ICU fellow again, which I will, you know, next year I'm going to go back to New York and do that. But it's crazy to think that the reason why I went into medicine is to help people like me. And so I'm ready to do that. I think it's going to be like a, you know, I'm halfway there. But I think by July, which is when I start the program, I'll be 100% ready.
And so now that you have this experience, and you think you'll see patients differently, do you think that this builds, you know, a level of empathy that I think a lot of people don't have? Because you're young, you're like, I'm 30, hey, boom, boom, nothing hurts, you can keep going. But then you literally went through this.
Yeah.
And now you're going to be seeing patients who are going through this, the same thing.
Oh, 100%. I don't think you have to be I don't think you have to go through this to be a good doctor, and I want everybody to know that. Like, I hate when people say, like, oh, you're going to be such a good doctor now that you've gone through everything. Like, no, no, no. There are plenty of good doctors, and you don't have to go through, like cardiac arrest to become a good doctor, I assure you. And, you know, there are plenty of bad doctors who probably have gone through stuff, you know. But I do think it makes you a different type of doctor. I do think that I'll become more empathetic. You know, I've had every procedure done that I've ever done to patients myself, including, like, you know, central lines and chest tubes and everything that, you know, I've so many times done to patients without realizing, like, you know, I'll say something like, okay, well, I'm going to numb you up really quickly. It won't hurt. And, you know, it's happened to me. And I'm like, actually, it does kind of hurt. So, you know, it does matter that you, and even, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, and I was like writing this the other day, but when you tell a patient, like, I'm going to use some numbing medication, you know, it's not going to hurt. You're not going to feel a thing. And, like, it's really important to realize that you might numb that physical pain, but, like, the patient is still mentally, like, really afraid of what's going to happen to them. And so, like, yeah, you might numb it up and things, you know, you might not feel a thing is very different to me now than, like, what it used to mean. And I think that's important for a patient to understand that I know what they're going through.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that is sort of the patients love that. They like you better when they feel like you know. Yeah. And you'll probably teach other doctors that, too, because that might be a tidbit people don't really understand, you know. And so, but I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, me too.
I'm glad you're here. Was there ever a moment? Did you have any doubts at all? Because being on that list must have been excruciating because you were there for a couple weeks.
Yeah. Less than a couple weeks, but pretty much. Yeah, I mean, there were, and I have like a very dark sense of humor. I don't, like, a lot of physicians do, especially like ER doctors. But, you know, I would joke about, I'd be like, you know, I might not be here tomorrow, guys, and people would hate that. But yeah, it was the truth.
Yeah.
Of course, like, of course you're thinking about things like that. And it was kind of a reality because I went back to work. I went back to work in July, and I remember I actually went back to the cardiac cath lab, the first one that I went to, like, after I had crashed. They took me immediately to the cath lab to figure out what was going on. And, you know, and I remember I, like, walked in, and everybody, like, the cardiologist who initially treated me came out, and he hugged me, and, like, all the fellows came in, and, like, people were shaking my hand, and I was just laughing, and I'm like, you guys, like, cardiology, like, this is your field. Like, why are you so excited to see me? And they were like, yeah, but, like, we don't usually see this. And that's when, like, my heart kind of sank, and I'm like, oh, like, you guys didn't think I was going to make it? And, you know, like, it's the truth, though. You know, it is. There are times when, you know, that when they said that, I was like, oh, my God. Like, there actually was a time when I could have not made it. So that was really crazy to hear.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that ran through my head many times.
So your advice to people out there who may be on the, you know, they just didn't even pay attention about whether or not they should check that box, getting their driver's license or log on to donorsone.org.
Mm-hmm.
Your advice to folks out there.
Definitely become an organ donor. You do know that becoming an organ donor with just one organ donor, you can actually save up to 8 lives and improve the lives of up to like 100 people. With that being said, you know, it's not just major organs that you use tendons and cornea and, you know, things like that, too. So don't forget that. Doesn't matter, you know, how sick you are, how old you are. You can always be an organ donor and let the organ donation organization figure out if you can, you know, what they can use and what they can't use. So it's really important for people, for everybody to be.
And because of your organ donor, you're here to hopefully save many, many lives.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Like, impact a lot of lives.
I hope so.
So thank you, Dr. Aline Grigosian, for coming into the KYW studios and sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.